This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Welcome to Savage Starlight, the officially unofficial podcast for The Last of Us on HBO. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And today we're talking about Season 1, Episode 4, but we're not talking about it. You're talking about it. I'm not crying. You're crying, Aaron. I don't know. There was nothing to cry about in this episode, but I hear there is plenty of feedback to talk about.
Oh, yeah. No shortage of that. I don't think we talked about this in the main podcast, the fact that this show continues to grow. You know, it posted like a 7.8 million share for whatever that first, I don't think that's the 3 day plus kind of number, but yeah, like we start off at 5 million and then it was up to like, you know, six point something. And now it's like, at the end of its run, House of the Dragon was about 10 to 11 million. It started that way and just kind of stayed and maintained its audience. And, you know, someone pointed out that this just doesn't really happen. It was a case in the early going of the golden age of television when people were just finding out about streaming and stuff that like shows would gain steam over season. But through a season that you're actually each week about another million people mosey on over and start watching the show. Pretty crazy. Pretty crazy. So that's really exciting. Also, a lot of people wrote in and said they were touched by the mere recollection of this damn dying pet poem that I misremembered the title of. So a lot of people wrote in and like, what is the name of that poem? I want to read it for myself. I'm going through something similar, etc. It is May I Go Now by Susan A. Jackson. And again, it's pretty strong stuff. I still am not thinking about it, so I don't get choked up. if you want pain, or I guess comfort in the long term, that's where you go. May I Go Now by Susan A. Jackson. All right. TLOU@baldmove.com. TLOU at baldmove.com is how you get onto this feedback show. It's the only way to get on this feedback show. Have your strongest take earliest as you can get it to me. TLOU@baldmove.com. First up is Rachel. Did either of you make the connection between the soundtrack played during Frank's last day and the movie Arrival? The song On the Nature of Daylight by Max Richter. Of course, we know Max as torturing us on the leftovers with the ebony and the ivory. On the Nature of Daylight by Max Richter is a song used in Arrival where Louise, knowing everything she has to lose, still makes the choice to start a family with Ian. Tilu uses the same song in the scenes of Frank's Last Day. Had a very strong emotional reaction to Frank's Last Day, likely because of the complicated emotions I had watching Arrival and recognizing the music from that film. After three pregnancy losses, I may understand Luis's choice better than many. The profound love you experience when you know someone, no matter how long, and how that can be worth the pain of their loss. In Bill and Frank's case, they spend their last day reflecting on their lives together, and Bill finds an unexpected fulfillment in his choice to bring Frank into his life. Both Luis and Bill know that choosing love brings with it the threat of sorrow, but it brings purpose to their lives that they would have never had without. Boy, Arrival packs a punch.
Yeah.
And I'm surprised because I just rewatched Arrival late last year. It was kind of fresh in my mind. I went through kind of like a mini sci-fi marathon for myself. And yeah, late stage Arrival packs a punch. I'm surprised I didn't recognize the music as belonging to that film. It's a great choice.
Mm-hmm.
Can't go wrong with Max Richter if you're wanting people to feel feelings. Bradley from Indiana, fellow former Hoosier. Well, I guess he's a fellow Hoosier. I'm a former Hoosier. We used to be Hoosiers. We used to dig coal. I was just listening to your recap from episode 3, and there was something you mentioned that I initially agreed with, but after rewatch felt totally different about. Hear me out. You both seem to agree that Bill's solo gun battle in the middle of the street was totally out of character for this normally very cold and calculated man who watches the infected get brained through his video monitor. While true on the face of things, I think it overlooks the love that Frank consistently brought out to this more irrational, vulnerable, and impulsive side of Bill. This is evident from the very first scene together, where against his very much better judgment, he allows Frank, a complete stranger lurking in his backyard, into his home for lunch and then into his bed. Years later, in the strawberry patch, he wistfully admits that he never felt afraid until Frank showed up. In their last scene together, when he takes the pills in his own wine and gulps it down because Frank was his purpose. Pre-Frank Bill would have never taken his own life before his time had come. He was a self-proclaimed survivalist, after all, the objective antithesis of being suicidal. Given all that context and intention, I can't believe that the writers of the show wrote a sloppy, careless shootout scene just because they couldn't do better than that. I think they were trying to demonstrate, that Bill realized that the raiders Joel warned him of had finally come and that he was genuinely fearful that they could hurt Frank, so he acted impulsively and recklessly out of fear and love. Jim, what do you make of this theory?
I mean, yeah, if that's the way you want to view it, sure, we're probably going to have to agree to disagree, because I still think that love in this case would have been shown as preparedness by that character. Yeah. I get where you're coming from, but I just fundamentally disagree.
Yeah, I feel the same way. Like, I think this is a possibility. It could be that Craig, in his mind, as a non-survivalist, thinks that you could be so emotionally compromised in this moment that you just lose all your practice and your training and your preparedness, and you just, you know, go out there panicky and just I've known a couple guys with Bill's kind of mindset, and I don't think they freak out in these. They might freak out afterwards, but they're not going to, like, when the shit actually hits the fan. Again, I'm not talking about your casual guy out of bug out bag and might fucking hike out in the woods once a year and wonder what would happen if. I'm talking about the people that, like, are that have two basements.
If you
have two fucking basements, then you're not going to freak out if someone comes for your family in the apocalypse. You're just not. I just don't think you will. Mike H. from St. Louis says, in the Lord of the Rings Fellowship of the Ring movie, there's a great chase sequence where the ring wraiths are chasing the hobbits through the Shire. The hobbits get caught under overhang of tree roots with the Nazgul trying to sniff them out. They pull a classic move of throwing something in the distance to create a sound, sparking the Nazgul to chase it, giving our heroes some breathing room and a head start to safety. Watching The Last of Us Episode 2 in the museum sequence, it seems they could have used this tactic just endlessly to trick the clickers. Is there any insight as to why they don't use a super simple tactic often, other than it makes for bad storytelling?
Somebody's played the game. The game, you use a lot of bricks and bottles to distract and lead enemies away and in the direction you prefer them to go. I don't know. I don't know why they don't put that in the show.
Yeah, I felt like that they gestured towards it when Joel knocked that statue over. I felt like that was to make a giant commotion to, you know,
mask his own footsteps.
But yeah, like, they had so much at that point stuff that they could just throw and kind of distract. And it's such an obvious game mechanic that it felt, as a game player, like an intentional omission. Maybe they're saving that for, like, oh, Joel's got a new wrinkle he grew on his ass for later. But
maybe he's going to have some epiphany where he's like, God, I could throw a bottle. What if I threw a bottle?
I could be invincible. My God, they go towards sound. I can generate sound remotely.
Uh-huh.
And it's not like the be all end all of tactics, right? You know, you can throw a bottle and still, you know, trip on your shoelace and fall over and the clickers get right on you. And what, the tentacles or the tendrils, who the fuck knows? So
yeah, Joel's having bad luck with the sound stuff so far. Like, the glass stuff is just not working out for him, right? Like,
it's
in the museum, he steps on the glass. In the tower, he puts down the glass and he hopes that intruders will step on it and he'll hear it, and he doesn't. And
he's just too deaf. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's the breaking glass is not working. Not working
he's
for the old Joel.
Aurally challenged.
John M. was the first of many to write in and talk about the device, the mysterious coffee-making device. He says, it's called a percolator. You put the water in the bottom, right. The grounds go above it in a filter-esque chamber. Then you boil it up. The bubbles, it bubbles up and over into the collection reservoir like a reverse drip. It's a camping staple for coffee making. A couple other people mentioned that since it recycles the water again and again and again, that like you can make some pretty fucking strong coffee.
Oh, boy.
It's like distilling coffee. And it's funny because when I was listening to the podcast, I actually were trying to say, what do you call that thing? It's like, I don't know. It's like just percolating the coffee. It's called a percolator.
Uh-huh. Sure. Makes sense.
Apparently, it's really popular in Italy. Have you seen any percolators in your travels to Italia?
In Italy? I mean, in Italy, they're drinking espresso, which
it's called it's called like a Grecchio.
Maybe it's popular within like home kitchens and stuff. It's definitely not popular in cafes for sure.
Did you ever get to make that in Sicily? Maybe it's a Sicilian thing.
No, I didn't.
They percolate the shit out of coffee in Sicily. That's why I hear. Troy says as a 50. Oh boy, you're gonna have to answer for this shit. You've been talking too much shit against the elderly. Yeah, you have. And I get roped into it.
It's a stairs thing.
You know it's a stairs thing. As a 53-year-old, I was compelled. And I've ducked a couple of these because you've been making snide shots about Joel and his physical fitness in this world. And a lot of these middle-aged men are not taking it, Jim. It says, as a 53-year-old man, I was compelled to write in for the first time because of the comments made about how Joel or anybody should be able to easily scale 45 flights of steps. Let me get this straight. You guys think Joel, a man who's been fighting day to day for mere survival, thus has not had time to regularly get in his cardio at the local apocalyptic Gold's Gym, while surviving on a spoonful of squirrel jerky and a can of 20-year-old ravioli a day, operating on 0 minutes of sleep in the last 48 to 72 hours he's been driving, should be able to easily do more than 5 flights of stairs? Oh, young man, you're in for a rude awakening in the years to come. Why are you being so hard on Joel, Jim?
Well, look, I'm not that young a man.
You're 40.
I understand what aging is.
You barely made it through a 24-hour marathon of watching television.
Uh-huh. That's with zero adrenaline, I will say. Adrenaline's a hell of a drug. look, here's how I think it should work. I think for every year that you are old, you should be able to climb one flight of stairs. So as you age, you actually are able to climb more stairs than you were the year before.
Okay, forget the
because
T-Lew.
You've had more time to work out, right? You've had more time to grow your muscles.
Yeah.
I mean, it just makes sense.
Yeah, no, that's how it works. Forget the T-Lew. Do gym at baldmove.com for all that stuff. You can just bypass the general box. Go right to the man that doesn't understand his own biology.
Look, he's been eating Bill's food. Like those 24 hours, those 48 hours, whatever he's been awake, he's been just gobbling cans of beans and spinach.
Really short
I mean, he's
up.
Basically
really
Popeye.
Short him up.
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. Also, he's been working out constantly. Like he's been lifting child bodies and throwing them in fires.
Those are awkward bundles to carry. Really, the unused muscle groups when you're carrying limp corpse children to the burn pile.
The heaviest
really
bodies
great,
are the limp ones.
Really great for the styration in your latissimus dorsi, they say.
Yeah.
You know, I saw that.
And he does a squat. Every child body he lifts, he does a squat too. So
Yeah. He's good. Yeah, you got to lift with your legs, not with your back. With those awkward kind of gawky kind of, you know, corpse bundles that you're shifting around.
Maybe that was a problem. He was climbing stairs with his back. You're supposed to do that with your legs, Joel.
just if you ever start to do your back, and when they say put your back into it, that's a rookie mistake. You keep your back out, put your legs in for everything. Dan Webb from Kingston, Canada says, I think this whole gasoline situation is the plot elephant in the room. Stopping and siphoning 20-year-old gasoline from a random moss-covered vehicle in an abandoned freeway. Kind of ridiculous. That's the thing. We didn't talk about that. The vehicle that he's sticking this siphon into looks like it was buried in Mammoth Cave for 300 years. I mean, it is seen better days. Like the idea that the tank has not rusted out on this vehicle is almost too much to imagine. I know Joel briefly touched on the degradation issue, but 20 years? No way. I accept that Fedra probably has some limited refining capabilities, but random old cars on the road? Definitely not believable that the gas could still be used. I did a bit of online searching, and overall it seems that even under carefully controlled storage and fuel stabilizer treatment conditions, you get 3 years max. I read that the U.S. strategic fuel reserves are rotated out after just 6 months. That being said, I guess suspension of disbelief is important when to maintain when watching a TV show about zombie mushrooms taking over the world. True! But still, every little bit of realism, I think, helps that suspension.
Yeah.
You know, when I played the first Last of Us, I didn't have the gas bug up my butt. I can't remember what first gave me the clue that, like, oh, gas doesn't last. Oh, it might have been, like, having a lawnmower that you don't drain the gas over a winter, and then in the spring it's turned to jelly. Mm-hmm. And then to think that that, that is happening in every post-apocalyptic car.
Yeah.
And yet, yeah, we're just gonna siphon 20-year-old gas. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe they brought too much attention to it in the show, because I'm in the same boat. I don't remember having a problem with it in the game, even when I played it recently, like a month ago. So,
yeah. I wonder if they could have done it with biodiesel. Like, how long in a McDonald's gas... the apocalypse comes, every fucking McDonald's in the country has a fry tank full of biodiesel, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
How long does that stuff go? Can you burn, like, rancid oil? Because I feel like animal fats and stuff like that, that stays good forever.
Stays good for a while.
Longer
I've heard
than
that, gasoline.
Like, diesel fuel or, like, jet fuel does not have the same problems that gasoline does. Like, you can essentially have underground lakes full of diesel fuel and it'll never go bad. But that might be because diesel just kind of sucks as a fuel. Yeah, I don't know. These are just things I've heard. Now's the time to endure and survive. We'll be back with more Savage Starlight.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
We try to make it super easy to support making podcasts at Bald Move. Just join the club.
But some people aren't the joining type, or maybe they're already in the club but want to add a little bit of gratuity for an especially great season of coverage, or for a podcast that really spoke to them or gave them that bit of support in a tough time.
For these, and for whatever other reason you might have, our tip jar is always open. Head over to support.baldmove.com and click the donate option to say, hey, keep doing what you're doing. We appreciate it.
Once again, check out support.baldmove.com for all the great ways to help me and Jim keep making the podcast you love.
Just so we're clear about back there, it was either us or the ad. Welcome back to more Savage Starlight.
Ryan A. says, listening to the instant take, I was really surprised to hear two discerning viewers endorse the casting of Melanie Linsky as a post-apocalyptic vigilante mob boss. Look, she's a fantastic actress and is in no way an indictment on casting a woman as a power player. I love Netflix's Dark, and the majority of the power on that show is held by strong female characters. But Melanie Linsky's acting style is consistently meek and passive. She can go dark, but it's subversive and in clever ways, not through aggression and force. Completely strange credulity to show us this actress with this kind of whiny performance style of someone who looks like they manage a Wendy's where everyone called out sick on a Saturday. No way can she corral and lead an elite group of gun-toting Midwestern anti-government type psychos. Really morally loading our statements about we the people here, but I have a take on this. I wonder what you think.
My take is I'm giving her a shot to see what she can do, A, and B, I want to give the writers a shot to see what kind of character they're creating, because if you want to think of it in, like, archetypes, then yeah, she doesn't match this archetype of a revolutionary leader who's then going to turn into some government at some point. If they want to go for some other kind of character and break that archetype, I'm willing to give them a chance. So I want to see what they do with it before I really judge it.
Yeah. Yeah, I stand by what I say in the main podcast. Like, I think that there are a few ladies in U.S. government right now that could absolutely whip people into and lead, quote unquote, a revolution. Mm-hmm. But on the other side of that, oh boy, I don't think they'd have much to offer. And I feel like that is essentially what Melanie's playing here. That, and you can kind of see in there's like a panicky quality to when she's like, oh, this could be Henry. He could have a radio, right? Yeah, that's a reasonable thing. And when she's trying to like stick her head in the sand about the bucking and heaving pavement situation, that she doesn't really have a handle. And that maybe even like Perry is starting to see the cracks there. But like, I just think that I don't think you're supposed to see Melanie and go like, oh, that is a strong leader. I think you're supposed to see the cracks. Now, what blows my mind is that Melanie herself took to like Instagram and Twitter and wrote this whole post about how she was attracted to this role because it was a strong and powerful and non-conventional leader type and this, that, and the other. And I'm like, oh, my God. I mean, either I've fundamentally misunderstood your character or you have. But I don't like, again, and I hope with 12 years talking this microphone, I've not given people opinion that I hate strong female characters or I wouldn't accept a woman as a leader.
Yeah.
But I think this particular woman is not a great leader. And I thought that that's the story that the show was trying to tell me. I don't know. We'll see next week. But
she might have more information too, right? I mean, she's read all the scripts. She's performed the scenes. She might know more about this character than we do at this point, which is why I say, like, I'm holding off on really judging this character or this performance yet.
Right. And I've seen, like, even kind of like what I would say weak women be fairly strong in characters. I always think of, like, I know you have no idea of the Harry Potter, you're whole blind to that franchise, but like Dolores Umbridge's character, I think is an extremely weak woman, but is in a role where she's able to wield a lot of power and be scary and effective, you know? But I'd say she's a fundamentally weak person. And I kind of think the same thing with the Melanie. So I was kind of like, oh, I mean, yeah, weak people can find themselves in position of unimaginable power. I mean, look at Joffrey. Joffrey's a weak person.
God.
Yeah. You know, there's like tons of revolutions that have like been won and then lost by weak people. But yeah, we'll have to see how it goes this in just 24 short hours, really. Moving on, Peter from the Denver quarantine zone had a similar thought here. It says people seem to think that she, talking about Kathleen here, is not intimidating enough to be a leader in this society, which I think is a point in a traditional sense, but I believe what they're going for is showing how a Karen-type personality can thrive and dominate in the world. Apologies to all the real-life women named Karen out there. Premise I find very plausible. This sort of people, as we see them in our current world, seem to exist only to try to control others, espouse their opinions, issue orders, and enforce rules. They're known to be up in people's business, quote-unquote. Seems like without the legal system and the mores of civil society in the way, it would be a perfect environment for some of these types of people to flourish, to take advantage of the weakness and uncertainty of others. I wonder if episode 5 will give us any flashbacks or current details on Kathleen to further demonstrate these character traits. Man, I don't know. I don't know how well Karens would flourish, because I feel like a lot of Karen's power comes from within a legal system and mores of civil society. You know,
yeah, they're willing to go step beyond the boundaries of what most people are willing to do as far as civility goes.
Yeah,
but in the apocalypse, like, that's kind of out the window. Imagine, get shot in the head,
like, right? Imagine Karen leaning out her front door. Excuse me, are you from this quarantine? Pow! Like, just brain splattered against. You only get that kind of power as that type of person, where you can use the official tools of power to to manipulate and sick on other people. So I don't know.
Yeah. And I'm not getting a Karen vibe from her. I'm getting the vibe I'm getting so far from this character is somebody who would not have preferred to be a leader, but had it kind of thrust on her when it became personal. But the thing about her brother being beaten to death, to me, says, right, like, she didn't intentionally step into this role. It was just a bridge too far for her, and yeah, something had to be done, and so she did it, because it became personal. So I could be wrong about that. It could be she was already in a leadership position within the revolution, yeah, and then her brother was beaten, and just worked out that way.
It could
way,
be like a mama we'll bear situation where she saw something that so activated and triggered her in terms of her brother, mm-hmm, or someone that she saw as like hers to protect, that it's like, you know, been turned to this direction. Because I've seen that happen before where, like, you know, even women who are pretty physically unimposing or whatnot will act fucking crazy if you like threaten their children and their family in ways that are not necessarily directly effective or even wise, but like, you know, you could see if okay, they had like a team of, you know, people behind them or community behind them, a sufficient outrage that could be generated, that would be really powerful and easy to ride. And then like afterwards, everyone's looking to you like, well, you started this, right? And it feels like someone, yeah, who was not campaigning for this position, mm-hmm, like they got caught up into something and doesn't really know how to proceed from here.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not necessarily even I don't want to feel like this is like a feminine thing too, because like, yeah, who was that fucker that used to run Hilltop before Maggie in The Walking Dead? Gregory.
Oh,
Gregory,
right,
was that same type of guy. Weak as fuck. You know,
he just relished it a little bit more. But yeah, you're right.
Right. Yeah.
He had no business being in the position he was in.
No,
but people
listened to
him just sort of because
no one lined
position
up all the possible people and are like, this is the best one. Yes, this is the best one. It was a very peculiar set of circumstances that saw him in that position. So I, like I said, it doesn't have to be a strictly gendered thing. We've seen plenty of weak male leaders. I just, mm-hmm, think, yeah, it's weird that she's kind of holding herself up to be that. But I don't know. Like, she could also be subverting or just enjoying shitting on people on Twitter, because God knows it's fun. Anthony says, my opinion on this could change after the next episode, but I really feel like the tension would be much higher in this episode if we didn't even see Kathleen's point of view. We'd just be with Joel and Ellie and seeing them problem solve a sudden threat, and even feel closer to them on their journey. I know they don't want to make the show a constant survival grind, but it felt like too much of a release valve without adding all that much understanding to the world that presumably Henry will provide in the next episode. I'm not sure I agree with this, Jim. What do you think?
I think what they're going to do with this is going to be more interesting, because the thing you're talking about here is what they do in the game. It's not like POV from the quote-unquote bad guys.
Right.
You're basically with Joel and Ellie the whole time. So I think if they had gotten around to it next episode and left it out of this episode, that would have been fine, and it would have been pretty tense for Joel and Ellie. But I didn't have a problem with the way they did it. I guess I'm looking forward to seeing more of this community and what drives them and kind of where the show's going to come down morally on these characters.
See, I think that the Kathleen scenes serve a similar purpose as Joel and Tess and Ellie observing the sea of fungus people in the streets of Boston. Like, you just got into a situation where, from Joel and Ellie's perspective, they ran into a handful of people and they barely survived. They don't know what they've gotten, mm-hmm, themselves into. Then we go to a town square full of angry, agitated, recently liberated, gun-toting people. And it's kind of like Joel has stepped into this as surely as a tendril on a mushroom network. And to see that, like, we don't have a particularly thoughtful, solution-oriented person on top makes me more afraid that Joel's not going to be able to talk his way out or placate. And there's just such a huge force disparity that makes me actually more fearful for him, not less. But
yeah, I can see that.
Yeah. Let's see. Corbin says, in response to the scene of Joel and Ellie eating 20-year-old Chef Boyardee, I sadly have some related personal experience.
As
a kid, my dad owned a food warehouse and went out of business. And when going through the remaining stock, he found an 18-year-old can of meatballs and marinara sauce.
Yes.
Suggested I eat it. And of course, being an idiot kid, I did. Surprisingly, I didn't get sick at all, and from what I remember, it wasn't half bad. I do think Joel and Ellie could eat the 20-year-old Chef Boyardee and be totally fine. At least they have the apocalypse as an excuse. Yeah, it's my understanding that canned food literally will stay good for, I don't know about forever, but for a shockingly long time, as as the seal is intact.
That's the thing. It'll stay good as long as the can itself does, right?
Right, because it literally can't degrade. There's no air, there's no bacteria to be exposed. It's just a hermetically sealed thing. I've heard that the taste can go off, and maybe the nutritional value will eventually start to go down as the food itself begins to break down.
Which is not a problem for ravioli. It had none to begin with, so.
Yeah, it's ravioli's like, people like, wow, can you believe the pyramids still stand after 5,000 years? I'm like, what the fuck are they going to collapse into? If they collapsed into a pile, they would look like a pyramid. It's at its lowest gravitational potential energy. There's nothing to collapse to. Yeah, ravioli's That's like true. That. It's the yeah. lowest. The food's already done degraded.
Uh-huh. Yeah, they pre-degrade that food so that it can't do any harm to itself.
It's got no columns. It's just the food equivalent of rubble.
Jesus.
Dan from Austin says, I don't understand why Joel and Ellie didn't try to use cover of darkness to escape the city. I can't imagine power is on throughout the entire city, so there's probably large sections that are dark throughout the night. Once the sun goes down, use the cover of darkness to work your way out of the city on foot. Sleep during the day if you must, but nighttime is the best time to escape and evade.
This is true.
All right, let's take this first. They did, right? They you can't stay right where the scene of the crime is, so they quickly covered as much distance as they could and then got off the street until nighttime. I don't know that it's a bad idea to climb a tower and get a lay of the land. Like, do you want to go towards where it seems like the most of the people are, away? Or is there a big horde of infected? Is there another clogged highway that you need to know about? I think this is a great, like, get the lay of the land, sneak out the next nightfall, and proceed from there.
Yeah, sure. If they want to take a day just to get the lay of the land, I think that might make sense. I don't know how fast and furiously the... Kathleen's group is going to search the city or the QZ. I would at least like for them to get out of the QZ, because I don't feel like they were very far into the QZ. And the QZ seems to be, well, are they even in the QZ?
I think they're outside the QZ, because you see the gates of the QZ.
And it's kind of off to the side, and then they drive straight. So they might be outside of it, huh? I don't know. But yeah, they need to put some distance between themselves and Kathleen's group. But
if you overthrew the Fedra, why would you keep the QZ open like that? I would think that the wall, like, you would still keep the gates, like the perimeter.
Maybe they destroyed the wall to some degree. Maybe it's not an effective QZ even with the gates closed anymore.
Gotcha. That makes sense. I don't know.
The real issue was Joel got up five flights of stairs, realized it was going to take him all night to go back down, so he said, fuck it, let's keep going.
Dan from Austin also says, it seems crazy that Joel didn't take anything from the truck when they left. In any survival situation, you always have a grab bag, which has your basics, your food, your first aid, your water storage, your filtration, fire starter kindling, maybe ammo. The bag should be easy access and lightweight enough to quickly grab it and go. Ellie seems to have her backpack. From the looks of it, Joel only has his revolver and flashlight, nothing else. I know the truck arrived pretty quickly after the crash, but it surprised me that Joel wasn't better prepared for a quick exit. Joel surely has his backpack. Because that's exactly the game.
But my God, if he doesn't.
What you have is, like, you always are able to get to your backpack, which has your bare survival stuff and all the things that you're suggesting. So I would be surprised if we do not see Joel with a backpack for the rest of the series. Maybe.
Yeah, I would too.
Yeah, that's exactly what the backpacks are supposed to be. So I bet it's just an oversight that maybe it's been out of frame, or I'm trying to think. I guess, like, if he was the one scene where he should absolutely have it is at night when he's boosting Ellie into that duct. Like, that's everything that they're carrying clearly. I wonder if he has it in that scene. Let's move on. Michelle K says, I woke up this morning with occurring imaginings of Bill and Frank, not in a tawdry slash fiction sense or a zombie show lore type of way, but of the two of them sharing a sweet winter moment that a one-shot episode about 16 years together wasn't quite able to cover. Bill and Frank playfully snowing throwballs. Bill and Frank playfully throwing snowballs at each other after a Massachusetts December snowfall. Frank serenading Bill with off-key but well-intentioned renditions of chestnuts roasting over an open fire. Bill and Frank having a brief argument about whether to dig up Bill's mom's Christmas decorations from the attic as December 25th draws near. And Frank winning said argument because, let's face it, Bill's an old softie at heart. Which then leads to Frank mining the attics of the boutique and other Billville retailers for stored away holiday decorations to celebrate the season, much to Bill's dismay and secret amusement. Maybe they even invite Tess and Joel over for a holiday dinner or two over the years. Michelle, I think Americans need to embrace the grand British television tradition of the Christmas episode. I think 90% of every television series should have Christmas episodes where even if their run is not during Christmas and December, you can just look forward to, yes, I want to see Bill and Frank host Tess and Joel for a Christmas party. I want to see Joel with a big bag full of like transistors and shit to trade. Yes, all those things.
I feel like they used to do this, even here in America. You're right. It's definitely a British thing. Like, shows will come back in the off season to do it.
Yes.
It'd be crazy if they did that now, though. There are 600 shows. What if every single one?
Oh, my God. What would we do with too much Christmas content, Jim? I don't know if I could watch it all.
It would
God, throw me that fucking briar patch.
Hundreds of Christmas episodes. I don't know, man. Might be Christmas overload.
Well, I mean, I just watch my favorites. I don't watch every fucking television show. Like, their fans would have their Christmas show, and I would have my Christmas show. But, like, who wouldn't be delighted if the day after Thanksgiving, just out of nowhere, a Bill and Frank 90-minute Christmas episode of The Last of Us dropped? No one would be angry. Everyone would love that.
Yeah.
You get so many subscribers, HBO Max. And for how much could it possibly cost? It's a one fucking set and four actors if you get them all.
True. I don't know. Maybe Star Wars could do something like that. Maybe a like special around the holidays.
Now that's the monkey's paw curling. Okay. Maybe there's right. exceptions. Okay. And mistakes have certainly been made, but you know, I'd trade the horror of watching the Christmas special for all of my favorite shows having Christmas episodes during Christmas.
Yeah. I'd be surprised if they didn't do this at least one year out of the 20, right?
Yeah. Or like if they don't do the leftovers, they got so many other friends. Like a Harley Quinn Christmas special would be pretty fucking rad, right?
Oh, yeah. I just mean like Bill and Frank must have done this one year.
Oh,
they
yeah.
They must have.
Yeah. They there's no way Frank is not celebrating Christmas. Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
Cassie says, as a non-game player, it's beginning to feel like an overrated show to me, not because of the character development or world building, which have been excellent, but because four episodes in, that seems to be all there is. This is the dissenting email. For me, it's missing the key ingredient of an intriguing plot. One, the plot's super simple and can be summarized in a couple of sentences. Parenthetically, try doing that after episode 4 of Hot D. There is no real point two. There's no real B or C plot to break up the story, which can make the main plot feel a little slow. Also, the basic premise of the story makes it super obvious they will eventually form a close bond, so there's no real will they, won't they get along tension in the A plot. It's just a question of how long it will take. Three, they've taught us that every character except their main two are very disposable. Why bother learning anything about this Kathleen or Henry character when I would bet good money they won't be part of the storyline within an episode or two? Same as Sarah, Robert, Marlene, Tess, Frank, Bill. The main two characters have the thickest of plot armor on at all times. Who cares if someone comes at them with a gun or takes them hostage or a clicker attacks or if they lose their supplies? You know for sure that they will survive and carry on their trip. Five, you can tell how anemic this plot is by your feedback episode. They're using our show against us, Jim. How dare they?
How do they? I want to hear this.
The vast majority of feedback thus far in the non-spore lore sections has been about fungal biology and or outside mechanics. i.e. the amount of drugs in a wine. There's not much to say about the story or characters. I also think viewership numbers have been inflated by the built-in game franchise and the fact that there's literally nothing else on until March. After a gluttony of big-name shows in the summer and fall last year, the winter has been very dry, and it's the only reason I'm giving this a try. You're a poet, Casey. Cassie, you didn't even know it. I will agree with that last point. This is a little bit Titanic and Avatar. This is James Cameron strategy of run this shit when there's really nothing else on, and you're going to suck all what little oxygen out of the room.
And I will agree with the first point, which is the plot of the game is very thin. I think it is a very straightforward, simple plot in the game. A lot of the reason why it's such a great story in gamers' minds is because of the way it resolves. And it's going to take some time to get there. I think they're very smart to do things like the Bill and Frank episode, because that does give us, not necessarily B and C plots so much, but like something else to care about other than this journey across the country, because that's really... that's the summation of the plot, is the girl and man journey across the country as they bond. And then there's stuff that happens at the end. So, I'm with you. I'm with you. It's a very thin plot. I think they're doing a great job telling a story that I care about, though, with such a thin plot.
Yeah, and I don't know what to say about the plot armor stuff, because I will say that the first time I played The Last of Us, it always felt as if Joel or Ellie could die at any particular time, at any particular dramatic moment, and there was a lot of dramatic moments. Because, when you're playing the game, you don't have the hindsight of knowing when it's going to end,
True.
And for good measure, you can die a lot in the video. I did see Joel and Ellie die quite a few times along the way. But I never thought that, does that go to the end? Does Joel and Ellie make it all the way out to Wyoming? Like, that would be spoilers and stuff. But I would say that playing the game, like, I felt like it could be, death could be around any corner. And then when you get into like sequels and stuff, then who the fuck knows? And I feel like that's like good shows can do that. Like, I never, in one level, I kind of knew that like Walt and Jesse couldn't die in Breaking Bad, but there is at least a half a dozen times where I felt, despite that, it could have happened.
Yeah.
And maybe they are going to take this. Maybe this is going to be the last season, because that was the other intrigue of Breaking Bad, is like, are they going to think at in things after season four? Are they going to? So like, I think that, and the other things, like, back when I think about my earliest experience of watching Star Trek, at some level I had to know that like Riker and Picard aren't going to die, but like a good show can still make you feel concerned for those characters. The other thing is, like, I don't think mentally people are really coming to grips that this is a one and done. Like, there is a particular place they want to get to the story. They're going to get there in 9 episodes, and then that's done. And then there's going to come back, and they're going to tell the story of The Last of Us 2, Last of Us Part 2, and then that's going to be done. This doesn't have designs on being a 5 or 6 or 7 season run. And I feel like people are treating it like, oh, this is the next big prestige drama, so there's going to be a shit ton of it. Where are we? It doesn't have to be that sturdy. It doesn't have to carry 70 hours of television. It just has to be entertaining for 8.5. So, yeah. And I don't know where this thing's going to end up in the scale of like top 10 television. Like, I doubt this is going to dethrone the Leftovers for me, which that's my number one show of all time. But like, it's entirely possible that people think this is a really great show that was kind of like, had its moment in time, and then it just never makes anyone's top tens for the weaknesses you say. I don't know. It's many people's consensus top 5 video game, but there's a lot less competition for best story in video game title than there is in television and movies. So,
yeah, I don't know. We'll see how it plays out.
I just think it's, like I said, I think it's real good. I had high expectations and high hopes, and so far it's executing on all those. And I don't know what it's like to be a non-video game watcher. It's just kind of like bewildered trying to figure out why everyone's loving this 4 episodes in. So either keep watching or don't, Maddie says, what do you make of Bruce Straley being absent from any mention of the show? He's also a co-creator of the game, but I find it odd he's never mentioned by the show simply because he was never credited as a writer. I didn't know about this controversy, but I read up on it before the feedback episode. Are you aware of this?
No.
So I guess Bruce Straley was roughly 50-50 of the game The Last of Us, and he's one of the founding members of Naughty Dog. Had worked on all the Uncharteds, worked on Uncharted up through episode 4, or Uncharted 4. That process burnt him out so much he left Naughty Dog. Apparently, between Neil Druckmann and him, Neil did the story, and Bruce did all of the set pieces and the action and the programming and the AI and all the things that made it like work on that level. And before this television show came out, that him and Neil would always share co-credit. When everyone say you're the creator, it's like, oh yeah, me and Neil, blah blah blah. Bruce feels very used that he thought he contributed to half of The Last of Us, left Naughty Dog in good terms because he'd worked there for 15 plus years and done 5 successful video games with them, and now there's an HBO show and they want to do this in The Last of Us 2, and it's one thing to not be created as the writer, but like to not be created as the co-creator of the game, probably screw him out of quite a bit of money.
Sure.
And he's not attacking Neil. He's attacking like Naughty Dog, in particular, the industry itself. He's like, this is a good reason why we should have a union. You know, like we shouldn't be doing this ad hoc onesie twosie. Like, oh, well, is he a director? Is he a co-creator? What? Like, and I got to say, I'm pretty sympathetic to all those arguments.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a shame. I do think like just because he maybe didn't have his hand as much in the story as Neil did, it doesn't mean he didn't contribute to it in any way. You know, it's like, I don't know. It's like if you were going to go and remake or adapt some novel.
Yeah.
To the thing. And like there was a team of two people, like if Ty and Daniel from The Expanse.
Yeah.
Were credited. And one of those people is like the actual, like, writer who does like the writing, and the other person I think Ty is more of like an idea guy and set right. pieces, like kind of with Neil and the other guy, shit, what is his name again,
Bruce Straley. Bruce,
yeah. It would be weird for Ty not to get any credit on the show simply because he wasn't involved in the production of the actual show, but the novels he was intimately involved in.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I'm kind of with him. I think it's kind of BS.
Well, like if Stephen King got all the credit for the Shining, you know, like, well, Stanley Kubrick directed the damn thing. Like, yeah, you wrote it and came up with all the characters and all that kind of stuff, but like who expressed it onto the film was this other guy, the director. Shouldn't, you know, like it'd be weird to mention, I guess, either one of them without the other. And if they ever did. But I guess that's the complicated thing. If someone wanted to do a story in another medium based on The Shining, if they wanted to do a Shining film series, would they have to go or a TV series? Would they have to go to Stephen King, or would they have to go to Stanley Kubrick?
It probably depends on what story they were telling, because if it's based on The Shining as told by Stanley Kubrick, they'd probably have to go to Stanley as well as Stephen.
Right, that's what I'm saying. They use, like, it's mostly, because I think that's essentially what they did with Dr. Sleep. It's like, that's a story where it continues. Yeah. It uses a lot of the Kubrick's design, but it almost,
the story.
But not the story. It adapts, it's a sequel to The Shining, the book. But still, it's like, yeah, they probably did have to go to Kubrick's estate to get the likenesses of, like, the ghost girls and, you know, some of the stuff that he used explicitly to his concept of it. I imagine, maybe not. Hollywood's kind of fucked up. There's all kinds of immoral deals done at that time.
Sure.
No, it's been said. It's been said it's a dirty business.
I get it if like there's a true separation of duties, right? If like, because that's the thing, you see this all the time in film. You see where like people will be credited as like creating the characters. Or the writing specifically the screenplay, or writing the original the concepts, material that it was adapted from, like, and all those people get credits for their particular participation in it. it's if there's like a true separation of duties, if Neil was the guy who sat down, wrote the story start to finish, I don't have a problem with this. If Bruce was literally just coding the thing, doing like contributing to music, contributing to other things, and didn't touch the story, that's fine. But like, that's almost certainly not true.
Even still, when you look in these shot for shot remakes of some scenes in The Last of Us, they are adapting not so much what Neil was doing, but what Bruce was doing.
Yeah.
You know, because he was the guy who was directing and leading the animation teams and making all that stuff happen. So it feels weird to me. And if I was Bruce, I'd feel pretty. He's probably already a wealthy dude. And sounds like, you know, but I would be all kinds of salty. I'm at.
Yeah,
all
it's,
kinds
not, it's
of
probably
salty.
Not about the money for him.
Because he left Naughty Dog in 2018. Imagine if, like, I had left Bald Move in 2018 because I was burnt out or whatever, and you'd optioned the Bald Move story, and then it's just Jim Jones. There's no Aaron there at all. It's Bald Move created by Jim Jones. Like, motherfucker, okay. You've been doing it for the last four, but there was a guy. Yeah, I could see being super salty about that.
For sure.
Especially the kind of hours and that he probably put into that game, too.
Oh, yeah.
That's going to do it for our non-spore lore section. We do have some spore lore because this is based on original material, and people have opinions and thoughts based on that. If you want to send us feedback, it's TLOU at baldmove.com. Don't forget, this Friday, tomorrow, HBO is releasing episode 5 a couple of days early because they don't want it to overlap the Super Bowl. So it's good news for us. Tomorrow at 9 p.m. Eastern, Friday at 9 p.m. Eastern, The Last of Us will premiere their 5th episode. And immediately after it airs, around 10-ish p.m. Eastern, we are going to take to the microphones and do our instant take episode. Everyone gets to enjoy that. If you're a club member, you can watch us tape it live. And you can participate in the second half and get access to the second half, the instant talk, where you essentially post stuff in the chat and we react to it. If that sounds like a good time, go to support.baldmove.com to find out how you can become a club member and get access to that, as well as other expanded bonus audio options, ad-free feeds, etc. All right. We will see you hopefully then for Friday. If not, we'll have the full podcast out Monday. One day early this week, again, taking advantage of this hurry-up offense that HBO's running against the NFL. Now on to the spore lore section. Watch out for that fungus. We'll be right back with more Savage Starlight.
We found something to fight for. This podcast. Welcome back to Savage Starlight.
Hopefully everyone's had enough time to switch off. And if not, too bad. Victoria says... what I think is going on, she's a video game player, she clarifies, with this crazy bunch of concrete, is a bunch of infected have gotten trapped underground somewhere, perhaps in a basement or sewers, something, and they've been digging. With all the chaos going on in the quarantine zone and how these hunters have been harvesting goods, the noise levels have to have been so loud. We know the fungus has one goal and is to spread by any means necessary, so why wouldn't that mean it would try to force its host to dig if it were trapped? In the game where Joel, Ellie, Henry, and Sam escape from the city, they decide to go into the sewers where we learn about Ish and his failed community. Once you get past the main doors to the community, you get ambushed by countless infected, most of them stalkers and clickers. I wonder if this community is where those infected are coming from. The sewers really aren't that far from the QZ city in the game, and when you get through it, the hunters catch back up to you in the game. I haven't seen the next week on... but I will be extremely disappointed if they don't find a way to get this community situation brought into the game, because it's one of the best parts.
Yeah, it's one of the more memorable moments for me, for sure.
Great storytelling where your gradual dawning of what happened here. And if that somehow bites Kathleen and her group in the ass, because this is a whole bunch of people who just wanted to be left... To be left alone or to hide out and to have a sense of community and family, and it somehow is biting them in the ass, that would be pretty cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know. We'll see. Yeah, that's
literally biting
reasonable...
them in the ass, because those zombies don't play.
How long does an ass bite take to infect you?
Oh, ass bite. Boy, in the gluteus maximus, that's an 8 to 12 hour infection time, you know.
Damn.
A lot of tissue to get through, but rich supply of blood vessels and nerves, right?
Sure. There's a lot of muscle back there. That's all I know.
Ass fame for its nerve endings and blood supply.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The ass, the most sensitive part of the body.
Mm-hmm. It is. It is. What the fuck? Okay, Tyler P says, hey guys, we're not 100% sure who Ellie is referring to in episode 4 when she's referred to killing someone before. She's not wanting to talk about it to Joel, which implies whomever it was has really affected her. I think it's Riley. Obviously, Ellie did not murder Riley, but after Ellie and Riley are bitten, when Ellie asks what to do, Riley says, let's wait it out. We're going to be all poetic and lose our minds together. Left behind, we never get to see Riley turn. I think when Ellie has to kill someone, it's once Riley turns and Ellie is forced to put her down. I can imagine killing your best friend and first love has been extremely traumatic, and it would make sense why Ellie does not want to talk to Joel about it.
So it make a lot of sense, especially given like the question she has about, do you think anybody, they're still in there? She might be feeling like she had to like actually kill her best friend.
Yeah.
As opposed to kill the monster that was inhabiting her best friend. So. Yeah.
No, I could, that's believable. I was playing with the idea the other day of like, what if she's fibbing? What if she is saying this isn't her first time just to kind of like appear older and more mature to Joel to kind of fit in to like, kind of like, don't worry about me kind of.
Suppose that's possible.
She doesn't want to be seen as a kid. She wants to have more responsibility and more trust.
God, it's hard to. I feel like it's hard to back into that scenario now that we've driven past it. Because like, what is the scene? I'm trying to devise a scene where she could explain that without literally explaining that, without being like.
Well,
I lied, and I lied because I wanted to be seen by you as someone stronger and more
right. Yeah.
More like you, and like.
I think it's one of those things where you just have to surmise. But the thing is, like, if she's literally being true that I've done this before in the context of killing an infected, then what is going on in the basement of that C store? Because that felt like an experimental first time too. Do you think she's referring to that?
Oh,
like, you think that
not.
This is my first time, but I actually did one right underneath your nose, old man.
No, in my mind, it's more about killing
a person,
living human beings or things that she might see as human beings.
Well, then that's the thing. I can't square the literal text of Tyler's email where it's like, you know, it's like if she kills a person before they turn, it's someone they cared about, how would that be harder than killing some rando that's trapped in rubble? And why would she be wondering about...
If it was her best friend, I think that would be different. Right.
Yeah. Like
like Shaun of the Dead, where Shaun refuses to kill his mom because even though she's a zombie, obviously, just simply because it's his mom, you know?
I still can't explain the moment. Like the mushroom person just seems like, yeah, I don't know. Maybe she was, but like, so if she killed Riley before she turned into a mushroom person, then why? Then okay, yeah, you've already killed someone before. Why would you fuck around with the mushroom person if you hadn't and you killed them after they turned? And you're curious about, like, is a person really all gone? And she cuts and sees that they're full of mushroom. That makes a little bit of sense, but. Yeah. I don't know. Maybe that does explain everything.
It could. It could.
That is going to be it. We do have three emails for the Super Spoilore Edition. This is only for video game players who've made it through The Last of Us Chapter 2 or Part 2. So if you have not played the second game, you better get going. And I'm not going to give you as much time because you should be adept at playing quick time events. You should be an old hand at being able to get to your iPhone and press triangle before the clicker that is this podcast spoils you. All right, Super Spoiler. Tyler continues. He's got to take the spans both editions. After finishing your feedback episode for episode 3, you were wondering if Ellie could infect others. Assuming the show doesn't change this, part 2 answers the question in at least 2 places. At one point, you can read Ellie's journal in a flashback that her and then girlfriend Kat kisses Ellie. Ellie ends up staying up all night worried that she would turn, but thankfully realizes she didn't.
She bite her tongue off? What was the
deal?
Well,
I mean, I imagine if you're a 14, 15 year old girl, and you know you carry this thing, have you ever kissed? Have you ever tried it? Could you swear in a stack of Bibles that kissing someone wouldn't spread the virus? The fungus.
Oh, no, certainly. But I think about it in terms of like the spread of HIV, right? You don't get that from kissing.
You don't. Get disease from kissing, just to be clear.
Totally. Get AIDS. Yeah. Right. So this could be a lot like that, right? Where.
Right.
Okay, a kiss doesn't do it, but maybe if she literally bit them in the throat and there was blood exchange or something, that could definitely do it. But
I'm glad you got to that point, because Tyler also says, in the second instance, it was also answered in the big fight in the theater with Abby. Ellie bites Abby. We then jump forward to the Santa Barbara segment of the game for well over a year later, and we see that Abby is fine. Well, I don't know if I'd call her fine.
All right.
But she's certainly not turning into a fungus. Could the show change this? Sure, but until we see otherwise from the show, I'd go with what the game already has answered for us. So I obviously knew that, but I'd forgotten. Yeah, Ellie biting Abby, case fucking closed. As far as The Last of Us universe so far, that's not, she's not passing on this infection. Stu, last week you two had talked about Abby and how the show will handle season two. What I kept thinking about was The Walking Dead and how they treated Negan. I fear it's going to be even harder for The Last of Us fans who are able to get into Abby's story. As you two mentioned, it's different when you're actually playing the character as opposed to watching them on TV. Forbes just posted an article about them fearing that The Last of Us will fall into the same trap Walking Dead did with Negan. And this is an article by Paul Tassi about Walking Dead makes me worry about The Last of Us season two. Paul Tassi, I don't know, dude. I read this article, and I don't know that I can agree with his conclusions. So here's two paragraphs that are relevant. The writer here in Forbes says, for show watchers, it didn't matter that this sequence was pulled almost frame by frame from the source material. He's talking about Glenn being executed by Negan. Down to Glenn's eyeball popping out of his head. It was the fact that they killed Glenn and the way they killed him, which became such a massive turnoff that many people stopped watching the show entirely. That's how devastating and gross it was. And it wasn't just talk, even though anecdotally I know a lot of people who said they stopped watching when Negan killed Glenn. It's also reflected in the numbers. Glenn's death episode is the most watched episode in series history, and then immediately the next week the show lost 5 million viewers and declined every subsequent season after that. It never recovered its lost viewership. So I think this is a pretty myopic reading of the history of The Walking Dead. Number one, people were infuriated about the way they handled Glenn, but I think it has a lot more to do with him crawling under a dumpster and the fact that there was already a fake out death by Abraham than it is that people just got to the part where Negan beat the life out of Glenn and decided, oh, this is too much. This is way too much. Also, that is such a dishonest framing that, like, it was the highest rated episode and they lost 5 million viewers immediately. All throughout season 5, this show pulled 12 to 11 million viewers. And then it spiked up to 14 at the series finale because people were wanting to see this scene. And then when they played the scene the next year, it was the most, it got up to like, I don't know, 17 million people watching it and immediately crashed back down. They lost 5 million viewers to 12 million, which is exactly where they were. And they stayed between 11 and 10 million all that season. The massive dropout happened after that because they did not conclude the Negan tale. But they inexplicably kept it going for a whole other 16 episode season. So like, they're not going to do that. We're not going to get to eight fucking seasons before we get to the turn of the Abby storyline with this show. It's an impossible situation to replicate. And I think this Forbes article is bullshit.
Yeah. As two people who were there covering it day by day.
We got the receipts. There's like 190 billion podcasts over on the Watching Dead feed that testify to this.
And here's the thing. The other thing I want to point out, Craig Mazin had nothing to do with the writing of The Walking Dead. The Walking Dead was not a failure because people didn't like to see a character killed and then sit with the person who killed them for a couple of episodes. They did it because the show fucking sucked.
That's right.
It was terrible. Season after season, it kept getting worse and worse. And eventually, people are going to tune out of that shit. A, we don't have the time for this show to get worse and worse. It's only going to be two seasons long. But B, it's got somebody who gives a damn about right. the story that they're telling. And there is no way in hell that Craig Mazin is going to write anything on the level of a Walking Dead episode in the next... Yeah. He could do 15 seasons of this show and he'd never write those episodes because they're right. garbage and he doesn't write garbage.
And he'd never do 15 episodes seasons because I don't think you could do 15 seasons of anything and not have it be garbage. But
if anybody could, it's Craig Mazin. It'd probably like Craig Mazin. That's where
I'm
heading.
Thing is like, also, like, the other thing is like, yeah, what if Frank Darabont was still running The Walking Dead? Would that right. shit have fly? But no, we were four showrunners in by this time.
But he wouldn't have done the fake out cliffhanger bullshit. Like,
right.
the only reason so many people showed up is because of fake out cliffhanger bullshit that they were doing time and time again.
Right.
That's not what the show's going to do at all.
Yeah.
So...
It was not all holding hands in Kumbaya land when you Walking Dead got those 18 million people watching. There was people scornful of the process by then. So, yeah, I don't know. I felt like that was bait. And there's just that's like this is along the lines of like, what if they turn on the large hadron collider and it turns into a black hole and sucks the earth into it? Like, yeah, I guess anything's possible, motherfucker. But yeah, things been running and we're still here. So. Kiki from Canada has another theory, the latest theory on how they can crack the case of Abby, how they can coat Abby, the bitter pill that is Abby to swallow in a candy coat.
Ravioli? Stick her in a can with ravioli.
Abbioli. I want a 20-year-old can of Abbioli. Goes down smooth. Okay. Is that what they were trying to do at that final level? Were they trying to make canned Abbioli? Anyway, forget of it. Forget, strike it from record. Start with the season of Abby instead of Ellie, specifically the parts in Seattle. Interesting. You come back, part two of The Last of Us. There's no Joel. There's no Ellie. It's just this Abby woman in Seattle. Okay. What the fuck are we doing?
Mm-hmm.
Never say who she killed or why, but make vague references about her getting revenge and it feeling empty. It's a post-apocalypse after all. She could be talking about anybody. You build up sympathy for Abby as her friends get picked off one by one by some unknown unstoppable force. You show us every flashback except for the one about her dad. Watch her take care of Lev and Yara. Watch her caring for them to the point where she refuses to participate in the WLF's genocidal campaign, even when her own life is threatened. She and Liv mirror Joel and Ellie, although I think Abby's outwardly warmer, so audiences would take to her pretty fast. Then with her final flashback is the one where her father and his death at Joel's hands, revealing Ellie as the person who's been slaughtering Abby's friends, including her extremely pregnant friend and her ex-boyfriend, not to mention all the sweet doggos. Then ending with the "we let you live and you wasted it" line. I think that would hit hard. There'd be so many questions. Who did you let live? What happened? Why is Ellie here at all? Then you can start back where the game does, flashing back to Jackson with Ellie's part of the story. It's easier to sell an Abby to Ellie perspective swap than an Ellie to Abby one, especially in a show. They could also intercut some of Ellie's flashbacks with Joel to reconnect the narrative, or they could straight up lie and make it seem like this is an anthology series in a different place with different people. Imagine a freak out when Ellie was revealed. It would rock. What do you think of this approach, Jim?
I think I like this a lot. My one worry is how do you keep this secret? But I guess that's already true.
You can't. Like, you keep the game for the people who want to play along with the game. You know, who want to, like, when I say play along the game, I mean, like, do reasonable precautions about being spoiled.
Right. I think this is a really good, like, make you sympathize with Abby before. Yeah, I mean, it does fundamentally change the
You're working your way, because I when I was reading this, I'm like, oh my god, this is a great way to get the audience to accept Abby.
But
then I thought, is that what they're going for?
Right,
Do they want you to just easily swallow Abby, or do they want to have you to where you fundamentally loathe this character, that you're in Ellie's position, that you want to see her die? She's taken something from, and you are forced to walk in her shoes despite that, and are gradually, like, it might only appeal to half as many people, but those people will have twice as strong as an impression on what they want you to realize.
And if this is going to be the final season of the show, do they care if people tune out? Do they care if they lose those half?
That's the other liberating thing about being so in and out with this shit. Like, if people, if like season two is divisive and polarizing, like kind of like I think that's the I think the leftovers more and more people are waking up to the brilliance. But there was barely anybody watching that show in the beginning. Almost all of your favorite television reviewers hated it. It didn't get very much notice on like award times and stuff. Like it wasn't that, you know. So like, but that's fine. It's fine to make a polarizing show that nobody loves if the people that really attach to it and identify with it really fucking connect and it hits them hard. And I feel like that's what The Last of Us 2 is.
And if not every show that the company releases has to be a mega hit.
Yeah.
And this is where I get scared because like the creatives might want to do this. This is bold. This is interesting. This is something that isn't done much. Typically because it could turn off viewers, and that is always something to be avoided.
Yeah.
The creators might want to do it. I'm worried about the money people, especially with Discover taking over the HBO operation. It's
if
they
Disco
have
Max,
shown that they are very risk averse. I don't know, man.
Is it risk averse to give the creators of something this big the money to just go ahead and do this? You know, hey, you know, whatever your instincts are, like
if it's almost guaranteed to turn people off and that they will unsubscribe from HBO Max because of it. Yeah,
that's that reaction's baked in. Like they want to fundamentally. I don't know. Like I said, I really like the solution that Kiki has here. I just don't know that it would. That the people, if it successfully worked, that they would have the same experience that I felt playing the video game. And I feel like people watching this show are going to feel exactly the same as I did at the end of The Last of Us. If you make Abby more palatable through changing the order of storytelling events, it's going to fundamentally change the story. And I don't know if I like that.
Huh.
I would much rather. Half the people, like if there's ends up 10 million people watching The Last of Us, if 5 million of those people in The Last of Us season 2 fucking hate it, as long as they capture what I think is the core experience of The Last of Us 2.
And it would be bold, I think, to just throw you into Abby's shoes after having killed Joel. It's like,
yeah, it's hard to it's really hard to fathom, like the amount of. Oh my God, we're going to be in the middle of the podcast too. Like that feedback episode, you think the greens and the blacks were at each other's throats? Holy shit.
Yeah, I think it's going to be controversial the end of this season
Yeah.
I mean, it's going to, a lot of people are going to be talking about the show for those reasons. And
people came
I'm
out against Bill Frank being selfish. Wait until we see. The outrage over Joel's choice. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You and I might disagree on that too. That'll be fun.
Probably will. Yeah. but yeah, like I said, I think it's a great effort at getting people to care about Abby. I just don't know if that's what at the end of the day, I really is the most important part. Like, you know, I'd rather turn people away from the fully leaded version of the story than to water it down. But that's just my opinion. What do you guys think? TLou at baldmove.com is how you get in touch with us. TLou, TLOU at baldmove.com. Of course, we'll be back Friday with the instant take and instant talk. If you don't want to wait until the instant take comes out, watch us record it live. Support.baldmove.com. To find out how you can sign up for the club and get access to the instant talk sessions. And then, yeah, we'll be back on Monday for a full episode breakdown like we do. Probably be back to the schedule after that. Feedback on Thursday. I don't know that we get anything by advancing it to Wednesday, but should be fun. Thanks for listening. We will see you very soon. Until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
Bye.